All right, with that familiar music, it is time now to begin the reading of the Wall Street Journal. To kick off your Thursday, it's the 19th of February, 2026. And with today's Wall Street Journal, we say hello to Mary.
Good morning, this is Mary, and I'm reading the Wall Street Journal for the Talking Information Center. First story up. Fed reveals little appetite for rate cuts. The Federal Reserve officials signaled little appetite for reducing interest rates at their meeting last month, with most indicating they wanted to see more progress on inflation before considering any further cuts, a process that could take months. Moreover, even though two officials opposed the decision to hold rate cuts steady at their January 27th, 28th meeting and favored a cut, meeting minutes showed other officials would have supported more neutral language characterizing the prospect of a rate cut or a rate increase as evenly balanced. The minutes said those officials who would have been comfortable with changing the Fed's post-meeting statement to reflect the possibility that rate increases could be warranted if inflation continued to run above the Fed's target. Several participants indicated that they would have supported a two-sided description of the committee's future interest rate decisions, reflecting the possibility that upward adjustments in interest rates could be appropriate if inflation remains at above target levels, said the minutes. The Fed held its benchmark short-term rate steady in a range between 3.5% and 3.75% on a 10-2 vote, the first time the central bank had held rates steady since July. After the meeting, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said officials were well positioned and declined to specify what conditions would prompt another cut. That was a signal the committee saw no urgency to cut rates after lowering them by a quarter point at their last three meetings of 2025. The last of those cuts was usually divisive, with Powell arguing in favor to ensure against the risks of a sharper slowdown in the labor market. Others were less concerned about weaker job growth and more anxious about inflation that made little or no progress moving down to the Fed's 2% target last year. President Trump has been vocal in his desire for the Fed to cut rates faster, and 2 days after last month's meeting, he announced his intention to nominate former Fed Governor Kevin Warsh to succeed Powell, whose term as chair ends in May. Most officials, the minutes said, cautioned that progress bringing inflation down might be slower and more uneven than generally expected. The risk that inflation might run persistently above the Fed's 2% goal was meaningful, they said. Likewise, the Fed staff inflation forecast described an interval of more persistent above-target inflation as a silent risk, the minute showed. Data released after the January meeting are likely to embolden officials who don't feel urgency to continue reducing rates. The Fed is widely expected to stand pat against their meeting next month. Oops. And the social media bans for youth gain momentum worldwide. Places in Europe, Asia, and the US move to limit young teens' access to apps. Moves to bar younger teens from social media across Europe and Asia are going, well, viral. What started as an isolated regulatory gamble by Australia last fall has spread to more than a dozen capitals, where leaders are seizing on issues raised by childhood scrolling to appeal to parents across the political spectrum. It adds to a growing backlash against teenage smartphone use, which is being blamed by some critics for deteriorating mental health and an epidemic of screen addiction. From Paris to New Delhi, limits on children's access to apps like TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube are now being debated or implemented, marking a tipping point in the conversation about regulating social media and a potential blockage in tech companies' pipeline of users. In the US, meanwhile, Florida said it has started enforcing a ban on social media use under the age of 14. And some states, including California and New York, have passed legislation requiring warning labels detailing potential harms to children and adolescents from social media apps. Instagram owner Meta Platforms and YouTube, owned by Alphabet unit Google, are currently defending themselves in a landmark civil trial in California that focuses on the potential damage caused by social media apps to teenage mental health. On Wednesday, Meta Chief Executive Mark Zuckerberg, in sworn testimony, defended his company's practices amid questions about his company's efforts to secure more of its users' time and attention. The CEO said Meta's growth targets reflect an aim to give users something useful, not addict them, and that the company doesn't seek to attract children as users. TikTok and Snap settled the case before trial. Lawyers for the companies have said their products aren't addictive and aren't responsible for the plaintiff's mental health issues. The age limits proposed in European countries, including the UK, France, and Austria, vary, but are generally aimed at stopping children and younger teens from accessing platforms that offer scrolling feeds of short-term videos and posts. Excuse me. The new initiatives reflect growing political will to address whether widespread social media and smartphone use are to blame for rising teen anxiety, depression, and self-harm, and if the best way to tackle those scourges is to block youngsters' access. Apps often employ algorithms that personalize what users see based on their viewing activity. A feature, critics said, traps young people in damaging online environments. Others have cited potential negative effects of excessive smartphone use and phone notifications on sleep and brain development. In December, Australia became the first country to block access for under 16-year-olds, forcing social media companies, including Meta, TikTok owner ByteDance, and YouTube, to deactivate millions of teen social media accounts. Since then, the lower house of France's parliament passed a ban on social media users under 15, with a goal of enacting a law before the new school year. Spain is planning its ban for teens under 16. Leaders in Germany government have backed a ban, and the UK next month is beginning a public consultation on a similar prohibition. We will bring new powers that will give us the ability to crack down on the addictive elements of social media, stop the autoplay and the never-ending scrolling that keeps our children hooked on their screens for hours, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer wrote in an essay published Sunday. And if that means a fight with the big social media companies, then bring it on. At an artificial intelligence summit in New Delhi this week, India's technology minister said talks underway with social media companies over age-based restrictions. President Emmanuel Macron of France, in town for the summit, warned of the need to protect children and teens from what he called the negative effects of social media and AI chatbots. "We are aligned on that," he said. Macron argued that social media algorithms are based and challenged the contention by some tech companies that they protect freedom of expression. "Free speech is a pure bull if nobody knows how you are guided through this so-called free speech, he said. Recent studies in the US and Europe suggest that most teens use social media apps every day. In France, a parliament report found some 93% of middle school students have social media accounts. In the US, most teens between 13 and 17 said they visit YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram daily, with about one-fifth saying they do so almost constantly, according to Pew Research Center. Tech companies, as well as some digital rights and children's groups, however, said age limit measures are blunt instruments that are likely to backfire. They said the bans cut off teens from sources of connection, belonging, and learning. Critics said that the causal link between social media and teen mental health problems remain unproven. Bans will only push kids towards smaller apps with fewer safety protections, Jean Gagnier, who leads public policy in Europe, Middle East, and Africa for Snap, owner of the app Snapchat, said in an interview. They will backfire at some stage because they exclude kids from their digital life. In Australia, there is some anecdotal evidence that younger teens have turned instead to multi-layer online games, with chat functions not covered by the ban. YouTube said that Australia's ban was rushed and hasn't led to a safer experience for teens. Snap, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram owner Meta each said it is safer for teens to access the age-appropriate experience they offer. Depending on the app, those include content restrictions and blocks on messaging and live streaming, as well as usage limits and links to parental accounts. YouTube said it also plans in the coming weeks to give parents the ability to block their teens from watching shorts, its short video service. Several tech executives privately acknowledge that many of the proposed bans are likely to become law because they present an easy political win that appeals to parents on the right and the left. For some tech companies, lobbying has focused on scope to be exempted, or at least ensure competitors are also included. Meta and TikTok have argued that YouTube should be covered by the bans. Snap, for its part, contends it is primarily a messaging app and should be excluded. YouTube said it opposes blanket bans. The immediate financial impact on social media companies might be limited because many already restrict targeted advertising to minors by basing it only on broad categories such as general location. A more direct cost of new bans would be to cut off a pipeline of potential users who would stick with the app as adults. And the Zalab grab for data centers is a new obstacle to housing. And then in Prince William County in Virginia, Steve Alloy was preparing to develop 516 new homes in Bristow, Virginia. About 5 years ago, when the home builder began noticing something odd. Much of the land surrounding his site wasn't being acquired by housing developers. It was being snapped up by tech giants such as Microsoft and Google. A few miles away, a housing development called Village Place had the rights to build an additional 250 housing units, but the owner sold the land to a data center developer for $31 million. Data center developer NTT later paid $257 million for another vacant acreage. Land brokers started calling Alloy's company, too. That was how we first kind of got attuned to maybe this shouldn't be housing, said Eloy, chief executive of the home builder Stanley Martin. By November of last year, the home builder was ready to cash in on the AI boom, Amazon.com, which wanted to build data centers, agreed to pay $700 million for a portion of the land Stanley Martin had acquired several years ago. By November of last year, the home builder was ready to cash in on the AI boom, Amazon.com, which wanted to build data centers and agreed to pay $700 million for a portion of the land Stanley Martin had acquired several years ago for just over $50 million. It was one of the biggest deals for vacant land ever. The rapid growth of artificial intelligence and the surge in construction of the large data centers it requires are emerging as another potential contributor to America's housing shortage. Landowners and developers are finding that selling parcels to data center developers can be far more profitable than any other use of the land. Local zoning can make it easier and faster to build data centers than housing. Northern Virginia has emerged as the world's data center capital. It has open land, a growing power infrastructure, and a dense network of fiber optic cable laid during the dot-com boom. Loudoun County is home to a cluster of facilities known as Data Center Alley. The world's largest tech companies also have followed Interstate 95 down to Prince William County. At the same time, the region suffers from a housing shortage of more than 75,000 homes, according to the Virginia Association of Realtors. Nancy Pave, a real estate agent in Loudoun County, said she sold 80% of her listings last year at the asking price or more, and nearly all of them sold within 7 days. High prices and a dearth of affordable new inventory, she said, prices out first-time buyers. Similar dynamics are at work in other data center hotbeds. In 2024, Stream Data Centers purchased and then knocked down an entire 55-home subdivision in Elk Grove Village, Illinois, a data center hub near Chicago, to build three data centers totaling 2.1 million square feet. The company paid nearly $1 million per house. Land is selling for unprecedented sums in the growing suburbs near Atlanta, where data center companies, warehousing firms, and home builders alike hunt for space near highways. In Texas, prices for land along U.S. Route 67 near Dallas, which 3 years ago sold between $20,000 to $40,000 an acre, have jumped to more than $350,000 an acre in some places, said Scott Feenfoot, a residential land developer there. Some builders, he said, there's no possible way you can make those numbers work. In Northern Virginia, data center developers are picking off land that, in at least some cases, would have gone for housing, according to a December 2024 report from the Oversight Agency of the Virginia State Legislature. Between 2013 and 2021, data centers accounted for 20% to 30% of all land development in Loudoun and Prince William counties, the report said. Then, from 2022 to 2024, there was 50% more data center development than occurred during the previous 9 years combined. Compounding the problem, some rural stretches of Prince William County are subject to conservation protections, and other limitations on building. That means development of housing, data centers, and most other real estate is concentrated in a smaller area where everyone competes for limited available land. There's less land, there's less places you can do this, which really creates a supply issue, said Carter Wiley, a Northern Virginia land broker. In Prince William County, developers have been sending letters offering landowners as much as $1 million an acre. Some rural property that once sold for tens of thousands of dollars an acre can now sell for over $3 million. Homeowners in the county who once voiced classic objections to new housing, traffic congestion, and school overcrowding now find the creeping presence of the cavernous warehouses even more unsettling. They hate what they describe as an incessant ambient hum from some of the server farms and worry that data centers' demand for power will increase everybody's energy bills. Nothing can live next to data center development like this except more data center development, said Elena Schlossberg, a homeowner and activist who has opposed many data center projects. State and local government officials are growing wary about whether data centers are starting to crowd out development of anything else. Other kinds of development, said Prince William County Planning Commission member Chris Carroll, are just getting priced out left and right. Last year, Loudoun County tightened policies for data center development. Now, all proposed server farms must be approved by a county board. Many projects that were already planned were grandfathered in. That includes a data center by developer Cyrus One on a site where 800 housing units were once planned. Housing that faced some opposition from local officials and the community. The housing builder, Westbrook Partners, sold the land for more than $2 million an acre. One bill in the state legislature would limit data center construction to land that is already zoned for used for industrial purposes. You basically have data centers outbidding residential developers, said Andrew Clark, a lobbyist for the Home Builders Association of Virginia, during a January state legislative hearing. When home builder Stanley Martin was still trying to drum up political support to sell its land in Prince William County, many homeowners in a nearby subdivision were dead set against the deal. A company employee called Republican County Supervisor Janine Lawson one day while she was driving a car. Stanley Martin would consider buying out every dissenting homeowner in a nearby subdivision to get the data center deal done, the employee said on the call. There were some 170 homes in and around the subdivision. So, this tragedy might have cost the company more than $100 million. It was a price worth paying to clinch a $700 million deal with Amazon. I about drove the car off the road, said Lawson. I had no idea of this kind of money. The board of supervisors approved the data center without Stanley Martin buying any houses. An Amazon spokeswoman said the company's data centers create high-quality jobs and generate significant local property tax revenue that helps fund schools, public safety, and infrastructure. High-end home builder Toll Brothers reported record earnings in the second quarter of 2024. Despite higher mortgage rates that prompted many home buyers to build less. The company said the $185 million sale of a site in Loudoun County, Virginia, to a data center developer was a major contributor to the company's financial success that quarter. A data center operator came along and made us an offer that we couldn't refuse, said Toll Brothers executive Doug Yearley. Lawson, the county supervisor, was elected in 2014 on a pledge to curtail home building. She helped kill a 1,600 home development that year. A school planning supervisor had testified that the local high schools were on a pace to be at least 1,600 students over capacity. The new subdivision would add another 200 students to that. Some years later, when the data center started arriving, Lawson was supportive, citing the property taxes they brought in. She voted for zoning changes to add more of them. Then, AI-driven construction exploded. Her constituents were getting engulfed by the construction of more than a dozen data centers across hundreds of acres. Lawson lost a countrywide election to become chair of the board in 2023. She thinks her role in greenlighting dozens of data centers was the reason why. I misread my constituents, she said. They'd rather have homes than data. Deshondra Jefferson, the supervisor's board's current chair, also defeated Lawson. Who defeated Lawson, is taking a more pro-housing, anti-data center approach. Housing is something we need, she said. Jefferson is an opponent of the Digital Gateway, a plan to turn more than 2,000 acres into as many as 37 data centers. She recently voted to approve plans for more than 1,000 new homes on other plots of land owned by Stanley Martin. Farther south near Richmond, home builder H.H. Hunt Corp. proposed building 900 homes on land in Hanover County. Residents of a next-door subdivision called Wyndham fought against construction of an access road into their neighborhood from the home building site, killing the project. H.H. Hunt returned last year with a proposal for a data center campus that wouldn't require the extra road. But the prospect of 10 hulking data centers requiring 10 years of construction struck many residents as far worse than new homes. On a January evening, more than 100 locals protested outside a government building in the rural county wearing red and holding signs that said, "Grow tomatoes, not data centers." Many attended the five-hour hearing afterward. To those who wish to make a quick profit off our land, I'd rather look at my land than spend your money, said Clifton Cawthorn Jr., who owns land in Hanover County on a road named for his family and has booked at a developer offers to buy his property. A lawyer for H.H. Hunt made a case for the data centers, arguing that each year they could bring in property tax revenue equal to as much as 6% of the county's annual budget. If the county didn't allow data centers, he said, someone might again try to build as many as 1,400 homes there, setting a precedent to open up more of the county to subdivisions. In the past, the threat of a flood of new housing might have been a deterrent, but not this time. The county's planning commission voted down the data center project in a nearly unanimous vote, while residents cheered. Alloy, Stanley Martin's chief executive, rejected the idea that data centers threaten to meaningfully crowd out home building. There's very little overlap between where housing will go and where data centers will go. Prince William's County land rush continues. In December, a popular gardening store and nursery closed. The owners sold the store and its land to a data center developer. In a In a note posted outside the store, the garden center's operator called the sale a closure, a difficult decision. The owner received $160 million for the land. Next up is U.S. puts most air power in Mideast since 2003. The U.S. is sending massive numbers of jet fighters and support aircraft to the Middle East, assembling the greatest amount of air power in the region since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. The U.S. is ready to take action against Iran, but President Trump hasn't decided whether to order strikes, and if he does, whether the aim would be to halt Iran's already battered nuclear program, wipe out its missile force, or try to topple the regime. Over the past few days, the U.S. has continued to move cutting-edge F-35 and F-22 fighters toward the Middle East, according to flight tracking data and a U.S. official. A second aircraft carrier loaded with attack and electronic warfare planes is on the way. Command and control aircraft, which are vital for orchestrating large air campaigns, are inbound. And critical air defenses have been deployed to the region in recent weeks. The firepower will provide the U.S. the option of carrying out a sustained weeks-long air war against Iran instead of the one-and-done midnight hammer strike that the U.S. carried out in June against three Iranian nuclear sites, U.S. officials said. The build-up comes as representatives from the U.S. and Iran meet in Geneva this week to negotiate a possible deal over Iranian enrichment of uranium. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said there had been a little bit of progress in those talks, but added, "We're still very far apart on some issues. Iran is expected to offer a more detailed proposal to the U.S. in the next few weeks," she said. Trump has received multiple briefings on his military options, should he choose to strike, all of them designed to maximize damage to Iran's regime and its regional proxies, U.S. officials said. The options include a campaign to kill scores of Iranian political and military leaders with the goal of overthrowing the government, U.S. and foreign officials said, as well as an air attack that would limit to striking key targets, including nuclear and ballistic missile facilities. Both would involve a potentially weeks-long operation. Trump, a Republican, hasn't yet decided whether to order strikes against Iran, the U.S. officials said. Trump's national security advisers discussed Iran during a meeting in the White House Situation Room on Wednesday, according to a senior administration official. Trump has signaled he would prefer a diplomatic agreement that, if the U.S. got everything it wanted, would see Iran's nuclear programs eliminated, regional proxy forces disbanded, and ballistic missiles dismantled. Iran is seen as highly unlikely to agree to the last point, since it doesn't have much of an air force and relies on missiles as its main deterrent. Trump has indicated that he mainly cares about the nuclear issue, saying he would like Iran to stop enriching uranium. Meanwhile, some advisers and foreign leaders, such as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, are telling Trump that he should use U.S. military pressure to squeeze more concessions out of Tehran. Iran has some cards to play in a sustained campaign, including a still sizable missile arsenal that could be directed at U.S. bases and allies in the region, and military forces that could try to close the Strait of Hormuz, a vital sea lane for oil tankers. Given the uncertainty, some former military officers said a diplomatic agreement could be preferable to war. Frankly, that could come out of this is that the dramatic increase in deployed forces would be significant enough of an indicator that Trump is not messing around with the use of force, thus prompting Iran's leaders to come to an agreement, said David Deptula, a retired three-star Air Force general who played a major role in the 1991 Desert Storm campaign against Iraq. But U.S. and foreign officials are increasingly pessimistic that Iran will agree to U.S. demands. Instead, they said, Tehran might only be willing to suspend nuclear enrichment for a short period, perhaps until Trump is out of office. Iran hopes it can use negotiations to delay any U.S. attack, but it also realized that Trump is likely to grow frustrated with prolonged talks and order strikes. Foreign officials familiar with Tehran's thinking said, Trump has repeatedly threatened an attack on Iran should negotiations fail. The U.S. Air Force has moved dozens of jet fighters and support aircraft to Mawafi Sulti Air Base in Jordan and Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia, according to flight tracking data. More fighter aircraft are on their way. Meanwhile, the U.S. Navy has 13 ships in the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean Sea to support a potential operation, including the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln and 9 destroyers capable of defending against ballistic missiles, according to a Navy official. A second aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald R. Ford, and the 4 destroyers in its strike group are on their way. The Pentagon has also moved additional land-based air defenses into place across the Middle East, the journal previously reported. As formidable as build-up appears, it is just a fraction of the assets the U.S. deployed for the 1991 Gulf War or the 2003 invasion of Iraq. But military technology, including the ability to carry out precision strikes, employ stealth technology, and use space, has improved. Elliot Cohen, who led a study of the use of air power in Desert Storm for the Air Force and is now a scholar at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said an air campaign might try to so weaken Iran's leadership that surviving members of the elite agree to a far-reaching accommodation with Washington. If what Trump really wants to do is affect the regime and set back its ability to use missiles to attack American bases, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states, it would probably have to be an intense operation that would last weeks or possibly months, he said. And the Seahawks kick off a sale process. Allen Estate looks to fetch record amount for the Seattle Super Bowl champions. The newest Super Bowl champions are now officially available to the highest bidder. The estate of Paul Allen, the late Microsoft co-founder who purchased the Seattle Seahawks in 1997, said it has begun the long-awaited process of selling the team. The announcement came barely a week after the Seahawks defeated the New England Patriots to secure the second championship in the franchise's history. and teed up Seattle to potentially break the NFL's record sale price of $6 billion. Since Allen's death in 2018, the team had been placed in a trust overseen by his sister, Jody Allen, with a directive to sell off his sports assets and direct the proceeds to charity. But the apparent lack of progress on the Seahawks' front had rankled other NFL owners over the years. The estate had already agreed on a deal to sell Allen's other marquee team, the NBA Portland Trailblazers, last fall. Its failure to do the same with the Seahawks left ownership structure out of compliance with NFL rules, which require an individual, not an entity such as a trust, to be the controlling owner of the franchise. Despite that tension behind the scenes, Jody Allen continued to serve as the team's chair and was front and center during the team's championship run. After Seattle beat the Patriots, league commissioner Roger Goodell congratulated her on stage as he handed her the Lombardi Trophy. "It truly has been a magical season," Allen said during the ceremony. But the expectation was that her time in charge would be coming to an end. And under pressure from the league, Allen has finally kicked off the process. The current record for the sale of an NFL team was set in 2023 when a group led by private equity titan Josh Harris purchased the Washington Commanders. And since then, franchise values have only continued to explode. Recent sales of minority stakes in teams have seen teams valued at up to $10 billion. Sale of any NFL franchise marks a rare opportunity simply because of how infrequently teams in America's most popular sport hit the market. What makes the Seahawks sale even more rare is that they just won the Super Bowl. The team's recent success figures to make Seattle even more attractive to potential buyers. Led by 38-year-old coach Mike McDonald, 28-year-old quarterback Sam Darnold, and NFL's number one defense, Seattle is positioned to be in contention for years to come. So, for the new owner of a franchise that agonized for nearly 40 years before its first Super Bowl and another 12 until its second, the wait for a third championship could be considerably shorter. And OpenAI hires creator of a viral side project. OpenAI's move to hire the creator of OpenClaw, the viral maker of personal AI assistants, is a testament to the ferocious competition that still exists for bold and unexpected ideas in artificial intelligence, and the people who come up with them. Peter Steinberger, an Austrian coder and entrepreneur who hacked together OpenClaw as a side project in November, is set to join OpenAI. His creation will be managed through a separate foundation. Representatives for Meta Platforms and XAI also held talks with Steinberger during a whirlwind week that he spent in San Francisco earlier in February, people familiar with the matter said. OpenClaw agents work as virtual personal assistants that can do tasks in the real world. Users communicate with agents through common messaging apps, including WhatsApp, Telegram, and iMessage. The agents then perform tasks such as sending emails and debugging code and even calling restaurants to make reservations. Some technologists have suggested that OpenClaw could evolve into a kind of operating system allowing people to program their own personal assistants as more users turn to AI to help manage aspects of their lives. The speed at which OpenClaw went viral and Steinberger became a hiring target for AI players was reminiscent of the earliest days of Apple's App Store, where individual engineers built apps that quickly gained a wide following. The process minted near-instant millionaires and created the app economy. AI executives and researchers are also willing to bet on ideas such as OpenClaw that could emerge as a similar ecosystem. Meta chief executive Mark Zuckerberg spent billions of dollars to license technology and hire researchers, scientists, infrastructure, engineers, and entrepreneurs to build an AI superstream team. That blitz raised pay packages for top AI employees across the industry. Neither Steinberger nor OpenAI disclosed what his pay package would be. A person close to the deal said it was well under $1 billion. After taking meetings with AI labs that allowed him to preview unreleased research, Steinberger chose OpenAI because the company gave him stronger guarantees that OpenClaw would remain independent, he said. Steinberger released OpenClaw as an open source project in November, meaning it is freely distributed and anyone can help create and modify it. In a blog post on Saturday, he said he was working on making a foundation with a proper structure to keep OpenClaw open source. Explicitly, our mission is to work with everyone and support everyone, said Dave Morin, a venture investor who will be in the foundation's first independent board member. That means all people, all labs, all companies that want to play. Morris said that they are still deciding who the other board members will be, but Steinberger will be on the board, as well as somebody from OpenAI, he said. OpenAI chief executive Sam Altman said in X post on Sunday that the company intends to continue to support OpenClaw as an open source project and reiterated that it would be managed through a foundation. Altman also said Steinberger has a lot of amazing ideas about the future of very smart agents interacting with each other to do very useful things for people. We expect this win quickly become core to our product offerings. Steinberger will be joining the team responsible for OpenAI's AI coding tool called Codex. A spokeswoman for OpenAI said, Steinberger often credits Codex as a tool he used to build OpenClaw. It couldn't be determined exactly what he'll be working on at OpenAI, but Altman's X message and Steinberger's blog post suggest he will be working on personal agents. Steinberger will also have time to continue working on OpenClaw, he said. Steinberger started building OpenClaw last year as a weekend hobby project. He was semi-retired after selling a startup for more than $100 million in 2021. Rapid development in the latest AI coding tools such as Codec and Anthropic's Claude code drew him back to building, he said. The assistants born out of his project have gone viral in the past weeks for their ingenuity in completing tasks and communication. OpenClaw reached peak virality in late January when the AI's assistants appeared to begin communicating with each other on Reddit-style forum called Maltbook. Steinberger also soon overwhelmed with emails from users who were expecting a formalized customer support team. It's just me, he said. Then the AI labs came knocking. Steinberger flew from Vienna to San Francisco shortly afterward. He stayed with friends while in the city because he preferred to do so, but also because most hotels were booked for the Super Bowl, he said. Besides meeting with AI Labs, Steinberger spoke at a fireside chat and judged a Codex hackathon at OpenAI. In the same week, he attended ClawCon, a grassroots event planned by OpenClaw users. Enthusiasts lined up outside a building waiting to meet the Claw father, Ashton Kutcher, the actor and venture capital investor, made a surprise visit to meet Steinberger. Steinberger left before the Super Bowl kickoff to record a conversation with podcaster Lex Fridman, he said. Steinberger grew up on an Austrian farm and had been splitting his time between Vienna and London. He plans to relocate to San Francisco for the job, he said. Never would I have expected that my playground project would create such waves, he wrote in a blog post on Saturday. The internet got weird again. And BAE Systems post record revenue. BAE Systems posted a 10% increase in sales in 2025, fueled by large orders for Eurofighter Typhoon jets, frigates and combat vehicles placed by European governments. The London-listed aerospace and defense manufacturer said Wednesday that sales reached a record of £30.66 billion, equivalent to $41.60 billion last year. BAE, which makes a range of military equipment and provides cybersecurity services, also posted a record order backlog of £83 billion as of the end of December. The company's order intake was valued at £36 billion, it added. Underlying earnings before interest and taxes, the group's preferred measure of profitability, grew 12% to £3.32 billion in 2025. The European defense industry has benefited from an increase in orders since Russia's large-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022, as countries in the region seek to replenish their stockpiles, modernize their armies, and reduce their reliance on the US. BAE increased its guidance last summer and confirmed it in November. The company could see further growth if both the US and the UK's governments increase their defense budgets, as indicated by President Trump and UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Charles Woodburn, chief executive of BAE, said in a call with reporters that the UK defense industry would be ready to absorb the additional demand triggered by an increased budget, but it needs a clear steer of what's required. BAE's net profit rose to £2.06 billion last year, from £1.96 billion in 2024, slightly below a visible alpha consensus estimate of £2.09 billion. For 2026, BAE Systems expects sales to grow between 7 and 9%. Underlying EBIT and underlying earnings per share should both increase by between 9% and 11%, it said. The group raised its dividend by 10% to 36.3 pence. London listed shares closed 4% higher at £21.10. The long-term nature of many of BAE's programs, such as fighter jets and submarines leads to increased earnings visibility for an extended period, giving comfort to long-term investors, Richard Hunter, head of markets at Interactive Investors, said. Economic sanctions can bring critical pressure on foreign adversaries. Record in recent years. However, it's mixed. Targets actively evade sanctions and mitigate their effects. Even the most successful contemporary sanctions against Iraq in 1990 and 91 didn't reverse Baghdad's aggression against Kuwait, which required military force. Okay, and that's the Wall Street Journal for this morning. Thank you.